saying, again, again, when do we catch a break? Which is what happens when your football team last won a championship in 1960, when Norm Van Brocklin, who really would have disapproved of texting with an opponent, was the quarterback. There were other late-season jaw-droppers when it came to star quarterbacks, particularly in the largest NFL market, one with a QB who was a two-time Super Bowl champion and MVP. Eli Manning sat out a game, and the events that led to it were stunning. The Giants were a disaster from day one of the 2017 season. There were injuries, notably to Manning's two best targets, Odell Beckham Jr. and Brandon Marshall, but that didn't explain why they started the season 0-5 and dropped to 2-9 on Thanksgiving night in a loss to Washington. It was pretty apparent at that point that general manager Jerry Reese, who had played a major role in two Super Bowl wins, and Ben McAdoo, the coach Reese had hired after Tom Coughlin had been forced out following the 2015 season, were both sitting on very hot seats. That may have explained McAdoo's announcement on November 28th that his team's starting quarterback the following Sunday in Oakland would be Geno Smith. The same Geno Smith who had lost his job with the Jets to Ryan Fitzpatrick because he got slugged in the locker room by a teammate, I.K. Enampali. Manning had started 210 consecutive regular season games for the Giants, dating to November 21st, 2004. That was the second longest streak in history. Brett Favre had started 297 consecutive games and was the all-time leader. Third on the list was Peyton Manning, who had made 208 straight starts for the Colts. In all, Eli Manning had started 222 games in a row, playoffs included, including his two MVP Super Bowl wins over the Patriots. He might not have been a Hall of Fame lock the way Peyton is, but he was going to receive serious consideration when the time came. Earlier in the season, he'd become the seventh quarterback in history to go past 50,000 yards in career passing. McAdoo clearly didn't care about any of that. He'd gone 11-5 in his first season, and the Giants had made the playoffs as a wild card team. But the team's complete collapse put him in serious jeopardy because, even in that first season, no one had seen him as the second coming of Bill Belichick, or, for that matter, Tom Coughlin. So, desperate to try to find some way to save his job, McAdoo made a desperate move, benching a quarterback who was beloved, 2017 record aside, by Giants fans, not to mention his teammates, current and former. McAdoo might have gotten a more positive response in New York if he had announced his undying allegiance to the Boston Red Sox, or if he'd said that Lawrence Taylor was overrated, or Phil Sims. Manning made it worse for McAdoo by handling the whole thing with calm and class. He turned down McAdoo's offer to start the game and then come out in order to keep the streak alive, saying, if they want to play the other guys, then play the other guys. Starting that way would only taint the streak. He was clearly emotional that Tuesday afternoon talking to reporters, but was still calm and professional. The day after the announcement, Giants owner John Mara said the decision could have been handled a little differently. Then he expressed surprise at Manning's comment about not wanting to be a token starter. Like most owners, Mara had no understanding of a locker room. How do you handle a benching differently? Why would Manning not react the way he did? The Giants' locker room was a maelstrom by the time the team flew to Oakland to play the Raiders. No one, with the possible exception of Geno Smith, agreed with the decision. Ex-Giants and broadcasters weighed in, including Phil Sims. And around the league, other players, especially quarterbacks, expressed shock and dismay at the benching. It's just baffling, Alex Smith said. We all understand, and I know Eli understands, that when you're losing, the person who gets blamed first is the quarterback. But was there anyone in New York saying Eli should be benched? I don't think so. It just makes no sense. I mean, no sense at all. Geno Smith played reasonably well that Sunday, completing 21 of 34 passes for 212 yards and one touchdown. But he fumbled twice while being sacked, and the Raiders won with relative ease 24-17, the last score of the game coming on a New York field goal in the last 2 minutes. The Raiders recovered the ensuing onside kick and ran out the clock. Mara waited until the Giants flew back home before he fired McAdoo and, just for good measure, Reese. It was a sad ending for Reese, who had followed in the footsteps of Ozzie Newsome as an African-American Super Bowl-winning general manager. It may have been his failure to stop McAdoo from pulling the trigger on the Manning benching that cost him his job, although several less-than-sterling drafts probably had more to do with it. If there had been any doubt that McAdoo was done, the Manning benching removed it. The team was 2-10, and he had clearly lost his locker room before sitting Manning down. Once that happened, he had one supporter left, Geno Smith. Steve Spagnuolo, the defensive coordinator, was named the interim coach for the rest of the season. His first move was to announce that Manning would start the following Sunday against the Cowboys. Upon hearing the news, Smith said he didn't understand it. "It's not like I played bad," he said of the Oakland game. "I don't know why I'm not still starting." The answer was pretty simple. The guy taking his place was Eli Manning. 23. On November 5th, Washington East faced Washington West, the team from D.C. traveling to the team from Seattle. Washington East was banged up, especially on the offensive line and coming off a loss to the Dallas Cowboys, this one at home. The defeat dropped the team to 3-4, and having to travel to face the 5-2 Seahawks in one of the NFL's toughest venues, the season looked close to over. Doug Williams understood that, and so when Russell Wilson found Doug Baldwin for a 30-yard touchdown pass with 1:34 left in the game, he packed his briefcase, left his seat in the press box at CenturyLink Field, and headed for the elevator. He had seen this show before. His team had led the Seahawks 10-2 entering the fourth quarter. The defense had pitched a shutout, Seattle's only points coming when Kirk Cousins was sacked in the end zone for a safety in the first quarter. But the lead hadn't lasted. Wilson finally got his team moving early in the fourth quarter and capped a drive by finding Luke Wilson for a touchdown with 11:48 left. Coach Pete Carroll elected to go for two to try to tie the game at 10-10, but the attempt failed, and Washington still led 10-8. The teams exchanged punts, and the Seahawks took over at their own 29 with 2:22 left, needing a field goal to take the lead. They did better than that, going 71 yards in five plays, culminating with the Wilson to Baldwin pass for a 14-10 lead. That's when Williams' side stood up and walked to the press box elevator to go meet his team downstairs and thank the players for a great effort against a team that was almost unbeatable at home. Then came Cousins' two strikes for 70 yards that came while Williams was waiting for the elevator. The first one, from the Washington 30, found wide receiver Brian Quick for 31 yards. Quick had been signed in the spring as a free agent after 5 years with the Rams. He would finish the year with 6 catches. This was his longest catch of the year and by far his most important. With the ball at the 39, Cousins looked down the left sideline for Josh Doctson. A year earlier, Doctson had been Washington's number one pick in the draft, chosen out of Texas Tech by Scott McLuhan, who thought he was getting the big play wide receiver Washington needed, especially with the team's number one deep threat, DeSean Jackson, going into the walk year of his contract. Doctson had hurt an Achilles heel in preseason in 2016 and ended up catching 2 passes for the entire year. Most of Washington was still waiting for him to show the potential McLuhan had seen in him. Now for one play, he showed it. Cousins laid the ball out so that Doctson had to dive and stretch his 6'2" frame as far as it would go and reach for the ball as it came down practically on the goal line. Somehow he got both hands under the ball and hung on as he was being hauled down at the 1 yard line by Seattle safety Bradley McDougald. The officials reviewed the play, but it was clearly a catch. Williams watched as running back Robert Kelly plowed into the end zone before jumping on the elevator. Washington led 17-14, and suddenly a memorial service had a chance to become a celebration. The game wasn't quite over. Wilson actually drove the Seahawks as far as Washington's 38, starting at his own 25 with 59 seconds left and no timeouts. On 3rd and 8 from his own 36, he found Paul Richardson over the middle for a 22-yard gain. The play must have impressed Williams and his scouts because they signed Richardson to a 5-year, $40 million free agent contract during the offseason. With no timeouts left, Wilson rushed the team to the line. Instead of spiking the ball to stop the clock, Wilson tried to get off a real play, and it backfired. He was sacked by defensive tackle Terrell McLean for an 8-yard loss, which took the Seahawks out of field goal range. McClain got his hand on Wilson's foot as he tried to scramble free, and officials had to go to replay to be sure that Wilson was down by contact. He was. With one final play, Wilson heaved a Hail Mary into the end zone in the direction of Tanner McAvoy, and it was knocked away. It was one of the more remarkable wins Washington had pulled off in several years. Their offensive line was missing four starters, and they were playing in a place where visitors usually go to be humiliated. The ever-effusive Washington media reacted as if the team had won the Super Bowl, or at least a conference title. Williams and his staff weren't quite as enthusiastic. They loved that Cousins had been able to take the team the length of the field in the last 2 minutes, and Doxson's catch gave them hope he might become the star they had thought they'd drafted. But the offense had produced one touchdown in 58 minutes when not facing a prevent defense, and Washington had barely won the game, even though Wilson threw two interceptions, the Seahawks missed three field goals, and committed 20 penalties. Glass half full or half empty? Again, the curt yes or curt no arguments raged in Washington. Williams wasn't paying any attention. He was scouting the top college quarterbacks and checking on NFL starting quarterbacks who might be available in one form or another for 2018. He knew he was going to need a new quarterback. Both Kirk and Kurt would be leaving the building for good whenever the season ended. There was no point arguing his value. Other teams would ultimately decide that. Ryan Fitzpatrick, on the other hand, was very happy right where he was. The win over the Jets in his first start in Jameis Winston's place meant a lot to him. A week later, he started again, this time in Miami against the Dolphins. This was the game that was supposed to open the season, but had to be postponed until Week 11 because of Hurricane Irma. If the game had been Week 1, Winston would have been the starter. But a lot happens in the NFL during the course of a 16-week season. By mid-November, the Bucs' high preseason hopes had been, for all intents and purposes, shot down. Winston, the star of Hard Knocks, was watching from the sideline. The Dolphins had lost their star quarterback, Ryan Tannehill, in preseason, brought Jay Cutler out of retirement, lost Cutler to injury, and seen Matt Moore play very well and very poorly. Cutler got the start against the Bucs. He would not, however, finish. Once again, Fitzpatrick played the kind of game that had kept him in the league for 13 years. The Bucs led 27 at halftime before the Dolphins rallied behind Matt Moore, who took over in the third quarter after Cutler, who had thrown three first-half interceptions, was diagnosed with a concussion. The Dolphins tied the game at 20-20 after Moore completed a 61-yard pass to Kenny Stills with exactly 3 minutes left in the game. Playing on the road, having struggled on offense in the second half, it looked as if the Bucs were going to let another one get away. But they didn't. Fitzpatrick's veteran cool paid off. He marched his team 58 yards in 9 plays, letting the clock run down while the Dolphins used their timeouts to try to keep the game from ending on a Tampa Bay field goal. It didn't, but there were just 4 seconds left when Patrick Murray, the kicker from Fordham whom the Bucs had re-signed in October, after Nick Folk had missed 3 field goals in the Thursday night loss to the Patriots, drilled a 35-yarder for a 23-20 lead. The Dolphins tried to run a trick play on the ensuing kickoff, some version of the famous Music City Miracle of 1999, and ended up fumbling to allow a final unneeded Bucs touchdown. The victory made Fitzpatrick 2-0 as a starter, the Bucs 4-6 overall, meaning he had matched Winston's pre-injury victory total. "I really never doubted that we could go down the field and score after they tied the game," he said. "It helps when you've done it before. It's like with anything. Having done something makes it easier to think you can do it again. I've been in that situation countless times. Everyone knew what we had to do. It was just a matter of doing it." When Dirk Cutter had announced that the Bucs were going to rest Winston, the plan had been for him to sit for 2 or 3 weeks. With a team playing well, and Fitzpatrick, who was 22 of 37 for 275 yards, 2 touchdowns, and no interceptions in Miami, making the offense hum, there was no need to rush Winston back. At 4-6, the Bucs were technically still in the playoff picture. Realistically, especially with games at Atlanta and at Green Bay next up, they probably weren't going to make postseason. there was no reason not to keep playing Fitzpatrick. The Falcons, coming off the most devastating come-from-ahead Super Bowl loss in history, had started the season 3-0. There appeared to be no hangover from their remarkable defeat to the Patriots, who had rallied from 28-3 down in the third quarter to win in overtime. Then the Falcons went into a slide, losing 4 of 5. But they had beaten the Cowboys and Seahawks in Seattle back-to-back when the Bucs came to their plush new Dome Stadium on the last Sunday in November. The Falcons had no quarterback issues. Matt Ryan was in his 10th season in the league and hadn't missed a game since 2009. He had made 125 straight starts leading into the game against the Bucs, which put him 5th on the all-time list behind Brett Favre, Eli Manning, Peyton Manning, and Philip Rivers, who had 186 straight starts and would become the active leader a week later when Ben McAdoo infamously benched Eli Manning. It looked as if the game was going to be a rout when the Falcons took a 27-6 lead. But Fitzpatrick and the Bucs rallied to within 27-20 early in the fourth quarter, twice driving the length of the field. They even had a chance to tie when they again drove into the so-called red zone with a 2nd and 2 at the Falcons' 19-yard line with more than 7 minutes still to play. Fitzpatrick went for it all, trying to find DeSean Jackson in the end zone, but the pass was broken up. A quick pass to Adam Humphries picked up only a yard, setting up 4th and 1. With so much time left, the right move might have been to kick a field goal to keep momentum going and get into position where a touchdown might win the game. But Cutter was keenly aware of who the opposing quarterback was and knew there was a decent chance Ryan would take the Falcons down the field for a clinching score if his team was still up 4. Plus, the Bucs were going to need a touchdown at some point to tie or take the lead. So why not go for it inside the 20 with only a yard needed to get the first down? To me, as the quarterback, it made complete sense to go for it, Fitzpatrick said. Every team practices for moments like that late in the game. You talk in quarterback meetings about what you might do on 4th and 1, 4th and 10, 4th down from the 1. It's not like you're thinking, what are we going to do now? You know exactly what you're going to do. You have options and you choose one and hope it's right and you execute. The Bucs didn't have a lot of confidence in their running game. They hadn't rushed the ball poorly, 94 yards on 23 carries, but the passing game had gotten them back in the game and gotten them down the field on this drive. They'd rushed the ball once for 3 yards. So Cutter called a quick slant to Cameron Brate, hoping he'd pick up at least 1 yard, maybe 2, and the first down. But the Falcons sniffed the play, and Brate was double-teamed, and the pass was knocked away. It's a quick decision play, Fitzpatrick said. Short drop, get the ball there right away. It isn't as if you go through a progression. You drop and throw and hope it's the right call. Cutter's notion that Ryan would take his team down the field proved correct. The Falcons went 82 yards in 11 plays, taking the game clock under 2 minutes before scoring the clinching touchdown on a 14-yard Tevin Coleman run. The final was 34-20. Fitzpatrick was, of course, disappointed, even though he had played well again, 27 of 44 for 283 yards, and for the 2nd straight week, no interceptions. In 3 starts, he'd thrown 1 interception and had proven to the team and to himself that he was still an effective NFL quarterback. I really felt I was back when I came into the game in Arizona and we almost rallied to win, he said. That was emotional for me. I think it gave me the confidence I needed when I had to step in and start. It reminded me that I was still a legitimate NFL quarterback. So did the 3 starts. It convinced me that I wanted to come back and play another year and that I was good enough that someone would want me, whether the Bucs or someone else. After the last year with the Jets, I was damaged goods on the free agent market. I was fortunate the Bucs made me an offer. After the 3 starts, I felt pretty confident someone would want me when the season was over. He was hoping it would be the Bucs. He was comfortable with the team and the quarterback room. His family liked living in Tampa, and not having to move again would be nice. Of course, in the NFL, when both sides want something to happen, it often doesn't, he said with a laugh. We'll see. Winston was ready to go the next week in Green Bay, and Fitzpatrick returned to the sidelines. He was happy Winston was healthy again, sad not to be playing. But at the very least, as he watched the Bucs lose in overtime, he could smile about his present and his future. Even after the disappointing loss to the Steelers in Pittsburgh, the Baltimore Ravens had a clear path to the playoffs. They had three games left against three teams with a combined record of 8-31. At 5-8, the Cincinnati Bengals were easily the most formidable opponent in the group. The Indianapolis Colts were 3-12, and the Cleveland Browns were 0-13. The only road game left was in Cleveland. It was somewhat remarkable that the Browns actually ranked above eight teams in home attendance, averaging an announced 63,882 per game. By the time the Ravens came to town for the Browns' home finale, the fans could hardly be blamed for being worn out after two seasons that had produced exactly one win. The crowd on Sunday, December 17th, was announced at 56,434 on a mid-30s cloudy afternoon, but it looked closer to half of that. By the fourth quarter, only the 434 appeared to be accurate. Even so, the Ravens didn't make it easy on themselves. They trailed 7-3 in the first quarter before a Flacco two-yard touchdown run, the 16th rushing touchdown of his 10-year career, and a Flacco to Benjamin Watson 33-yard touchdown pass gave them a 17-7 second quarter lead. Watson's touchdown came with 59 seconds left, and it looked like the Ravens would take a 10-point lead to the locker room at halftime. But in what would later prove to be a harbinger, the defense allowed DeShone Kizer to take his team 47 yards to the Ravens' 27-yard line, and with 4 seconds left, Zane Gonzalez kicked a 45-yard field goal to narrow the margin to 17-10 at the break. The third quarter was a slog, the teams twice exchanging punts until the Browns made the kind of play that bad teams always seem to make. The Ravens had reached the Browns 32, only to take a Flacco sack back to the 41 on third down. Rather than send Justin Tucker on to try a 59-yard field goal on a breezy day, John Harbaugh decided to play field position and sent Sam Cook in to punt. Cook dropped the ball on the Browns' 4-yard line, hoping, no doubt, to fool the Ravens by not trying to run the ball from the goal line shadow. Kizer dropped into the end zone to pass and was about to be buried by blitzing linebacker Za'Darius Smith when the ball squirted loose. Brandon Williams, the 340-pound defensive tackle, fell on it on the 1-yard line and, untouched, rolled into the end zone. The touchdown made it 24-10, and whatever fight the Browns had left was gone. The Ravens played their offense very close to the belt the rest of the way, and the final was 27-10. One hapless team down, two to go. The Ravens were now 8-5, and had won 5 of 6 since the loss in Minneapolis in October. In an ideal Flacco world, the offense would have been wide open, and he would have been consistently throwing the ball downfield to his wide receivers. But that's not the way the team was built. The defense made mistakes, but it also created a lot of turnovers. Kizer had been intercepted twice in Cleveland, in addition to his game-changing fumble. The offensive line had improved during the season, and so had the running game, but it was far from lights out. The tight ends who had replaced Dennis Pitta had been workmanlike, nothing more. The wide receivers had been, to put it politely, disappointing. Mike Wallace had been Flacco's best wideout. He would end up catching 52 balls for 748 yards, well short of his best seasons. Jeremy Maclin was hurt for part of the season and ended up with 40 catches for 440 yards. Rashad Perryman had the not-so-small issue with holding onto the ball. He ended up with 10 catches on the season. In all, it made sense for the Ravens not to take chances on offense unless they had to. Flacco understood that, and as long as the team was winning, he was content to hand off and throw short passes, but it went against his quarterbacking instincts. "You always feel as if you can do more given the chance," he said. "I have a lot of self-confidence and belief in the offense, even if we were banged up early. We got better as the season went along, but I could see the coaches felt comfortable making sure we didn't make mistakes and let the defense make the plays we needed to win." That strategy made the most sense, but if you play it close to the vest, it means you're going to be in close games. There isn't very much margin for error. The Ravens had never been a wide-open fling-it-down-the-field team under Harbaugh. Flacco had thrown more interceptions than touchdown passes in a season only once, 2013, the year after the Super Bowl win when he threw 19 touchdowns and 22 interceptions, as the Ravens went 8-8, the first time they had missed the playoffs in six seasons with Harbaugh as coach and Flacco as quarterback. In 2017, after throwing for just four touchdown passes and eight interceptions in the first six games, Flacco threw 14 touchdown passes and had six interceptions in the last 10. Some of that was that he grew stronger and healthier as the season wore on. Some of that was that his offensive line, even minus Yanda, became more comfortable with experience. Some of that was the competition. The Ravens' second half schedule turned out to be easier than expected. Only three of their last nine opponents had winning records. The win in Cleveland was fairly typical of what the Ravens had become. The game wasn't pretty, none of the stats were spectacular, but the final result was a 27-10 victory, which was all that was important. The Ravens would finish with two home games, two victories, and they would be guaranteed a spot in the playoffs. Which in the end is all that matters, Flacco said. Once you're in, anything can happen. Six seeds have won the Super Bowl. The year we won, we were a fourth seed and had to win two road games. All you want is a shot at it. Two wins at home against bad teams, and the Ravens would get their shot. 24. The Colts were up next for the Ravens in one of those late-season Saturday games that the NFL plays when there is no college football going on. The weather in Baltimore was strange. Temperature at kickoff just a few minutes before sundown was 63 degrees, 2 days before Christmas. But it was a miserable, rainy day that left the stadium dark even before kickoff. Although the Ravens announced a sellout, 70,590, there were plenty of empty seats. This was no doubt due in part to the weather. But as with much of the NFL, it was more than that. The Ravens were sold out for the season, but the players had noticed empty seats almost every week. You sort of couldn't miss it, Flacco said. You'd look around before kickoff and you'd see a lot of empty seats. It wasn't something I was used to. In my 10 years, we almost always played to a full house. Even though the NFL continued to announce only how many tickets had been sold, once years earlier, it had also announced actual attendance, there were so many empty seats in so many stadiums that it had even acquired an internet name, the empty seat epidemic. There were plenty of theories attached to the declining attendance around the league. It wasn't just that more people were staying home and watching on TV, because TV ratings had also been down the last two seasons. In 2016, the average number of fans watching an NFL game had dropped from 17.9 million to 16.5 million. Much of that had been attributed to the most bitter presidential election in history between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Once the election was over, ratings had improved a little. But in 2017, with no election going on, the ratings dropped again, this time to 14.9 million viewers on average. The Donald Trump theory, of course, was that football fans had been turned off by two things, players kneeling for the anthem and new rules designed to cut down on head injuries. Trump took the Christians versus Lions theory that football was played to entertain viewers like him. In the same Alabama speech in which he profanely demanded that NFL players stand for the national anthem, Trump said this about the NFL. Today, if you hit too hard, throw them out of the game. They're ruining the game, right? They're ruining the game. It's hurting the game. Trump went on to say that while watching a game for a few minutes, he had seen what he called a beautiful tackle that had drawn a flag. In the 1980s, Trump had owned a team in the upstart United States Football League, which had tried to take on the NFL on the field and then failing that in court, where it had filed an antitrust lawsuit against the NFL. A jury found that the NFL did violate the law and had established a monopoly. As a result, the jury awarded the USFL's owners $1 in damages, which trebled to $3 because it was an antitrust suit. In the game of Monopoly, that award would not be enough to pay the bill for landing on Mediterranean Avenue, with no houses on it. Given that Trump tends to hold a grudge, it's probably fair to believe he never completely got over the sting of that outcome, the irony being that most NFL owners probably voted for him, and at least seven had given him $1 million in campaign contributions. In truth, There was no one thing that had caused attendance to drop and TV ratings to crater, a 20% drop in two seasons. There was a laundry list of factors that all added up to the empty seats and unwatched TV sets. Included, TV saturation. The NFL kept pushing the envelope, adding Thursday night games and adding to the late season Saturday schedule to go along with a Monday night schedule that was often not attractive, not to mention the hyped Sunday night games. To most football fans, Sunday was their day to watch football. An attractive Monday night game might get their attention, but the days of the Gifford, Cosell, Meredith phenomenon were long gone. No one was tuning in exclusively to watch Sean McDonough and John Gruden in 2017, nor would anyone get wound up about watching Joe Tessitore and Jason Witten in 2018. There was only one Cosell and only one Meredith. Then there were the games themselves. Because the NFL squeezed every last billion out of its TV partners, CBS, Fox, NBC, and ESPN, the games were loaded down with commercial breaks. Through 2016, broadcasts followed a brutal sequence. Touchdown or field goal, followed by a commercial break. Kickoff, followed by a commercial break. There could be 6 minutes of commercials broken up only by a, usually not returned, kickoff. In 2017, in an attempt to get away from this pattern, the NFL decreed there would be fewer breaks, but the breaks would be longer. Then there were the delays for replay, all of which seemed to take forever. Plus, the NFL had so many different new rules that flags seemed to fly on every other play. Games with more than 25 penalties called were not uncommon. In a Ravens-Browns game in September, 34 penalties had been called. When the NFL was at the peak of its TV powers, games rarely lasted more than 3 hours. By 2017, 3.5 hours was not uncommon. Attendance was down because going to games had become so expensive. In addition to the ticket prices, fans had to pay parking fees that were pure price gouging, up to $50 in many places, almost never under $30 unless you wanted a very long walk to the stadium. Concession prices were bloated. And late in the season especially, conditions could be miserable. Add it all up, and it wasn't that hard to understand why fewer people, even those with tickets, were making the effort to come, and why fewer casual fans didn't want to sit through entire games at home. The Ravens-Colts game was a classic example of why the empty seat epidemic existed. The weather was awful. It was essentially a night game, and it was 2 days before Christmas. That's why many people paid for tickets and didn't use them. The game wasn't much different from the game in Cleveland a week earlier. The Ravens got out to a 10-0 lead, an early Tucker field goal, followed in the second quarter by a 6-yard Flacco to Michael Campanaro touchdown pass. But as they had done in most games, the Colts hung around. And as they had done in most games, the Ravens let a weaker opponent stay in the game. In the second quarter, Jacoby Brissett found the ageless Frank Gore, a 34-year-old running back is roughly the equivalent of a 50-year-old quarterback, out of the backfield for a 14-yard touchdown pass to make it 10-7. Then it became a field goal battle. Tucker kicked two for Baltimore, and Adam Vinatieri, speaking of ageless, kicked two for the Colts, the second making it 16-13 at the end of three quarters. Vinatieri was 5 days short of turning 45. He was in his 22nd NFL season. How long had he been around? Well, his injured teammate Andrew Luck remembered going with his father to see Vinatieri play for the Amsterdam Admirals of the World League of American Football in 1995. Luck was 6 at the time. And now, I'm one of the old men on our team, and Adam's still kicking, Luck said with a laugh. As the fourth quarter began, the stadium was dark, rain-filled, and at least half empty. After Vinatieri had closed the gap to 3, the Ravens and Flacco pieced together a time-consuming 14-play, 75-yard drive that ended with Flacco finding tight end Max Williams from the 4-yard line for a touchdown. That gave the Ravens some breathing room, and they held on to win 23-16. I don't think anyone's going to call that one of the great games of all time, John Harbaugh joked, standing in the hallway outside his team's locker room after the game. But as long as we keep winning, it's all good. Flacco felt the same way. He knew there were no style points in the NFL. The Ravens were 9-6 and one win away from the playoffs. Given how he'd felt standing in the locker room after the loss to the Vikings in October, at a time when the offense hadn't scored a meaningful touchdown in back-to-back weeks, it was a nice place to be. The first sign that the last week of the season might not go as planned for the Ravens came on Monday, Christmas Day, when the NFL announced that all 1 o'clock games the following Sunday that had playoff implications would be moved to 4:25. The Ravens-Bengals game was one of those that got moved. The NFL made the change for two reasons. First, so that no one scheduled to play late would have the advantage of knowing what their competition for a playoff spot or playoff seeding had done, and therefore having nothing left to play for in the later kickoff slot. Second, to increase TV ratings by playing the key games in the late afternoon window. The Ravens, notably Harbaugh, weren't happy with the time change. "I don't think the NFL did us any favors moving us back," Harbaugh said, "but they don't care about us, so we just have to care about ourselves. We have to take care of our own business. That goes for our team, our fans, and our city. So let's go win the football game." Harbaugh was right about one thing. The NFL didn't care about the Ravens. It cared about what it perceived to be best for the league, not any one team. Harbaugh was concerned that a 4:25 start on New Year's Eve would affect attendance, even with a playoff berth on the line. A week earlier, team president Dick Cass had publicly acknowledged the empty seat epidemic in a lengthy letter to Ravens fans. After citing all the Ravens community activities through the years, Cass pinned much of the blame for the empty seats on the fact that 12 Ravens had knelt for the national anthem prior to the game in London, saying that the anthem controversy had been, quote, an emotional and divisive issue. He noted that in past seasons, empty seats had popped up when the team wasn't performing well, but that this season, the numbers are higher and it is noticeable. He again referenced the one-time protest in London at that point, without mentioning that the 44-7 loss to Jacksonville that day might have been a factor too. Clearly, Cass's concerns were long-term. He was worried that some fans might not renew season tickets for 2018. That was no doubt why he also pointed out the, quote, $120 million in ongoing renovations to M&T Bank Stadium, and added that the first escalator to the upper deck would be open for the 2018 season. Harbaugh's concerns were short-term. He knew that a third straight season out of the playoffs might put his job on the line, while a win against the Bengals might earn him a contract extension. The margin between success and failure in the NFL can be that thin. As it turned out, Harbaugh was right about fans not showing up for the 4:25 start. One could hardly blame them. The unseasonable warmth of a week earlier was long gone. The game time temperature was 19 degrees, and the gusting winds made it feel considerably colder. Flacco, a New Jersey boy who had played in the cold most of his life, noticed it. "One of those days," he said, "where you just couldn't get warm, no matter how much clothing you put on when you were on the sideline." Then the Ravens came out as if they thought it was a 5:25 start. Andy Dalton, the Bengals quarterback, was in his seventh season and was a poster boy for what it's like to be a successful but fallible NFL quarterback. He had been drafted out of TCU in the second round in 2011, and had become an instant starter and star in Cincinnati. 2 years earlier, in 2009, the Bengals had won the NFC North, going 10-6, and Marvin Lewis had been named Coach of the Year. But they slipped to 4-12 a year later, and quarterback Carson Palmer demanded to be traded, which he was, to Oakland. The Bengals also decided that year they'd had enough of prima donna wide receivers Chad Johnson and Terrell Owens, both superb talents, but constant headaches. They traded Johnson, a.k.a. Ocho Cinco, after he renamed himself in honor of his number, 85, to New England. They released Owens, and as it turned out, he never played in another NFL game. To replace their quarterback-wide receiver combination, the Bengals drafted Georgia wide receiver A.J. Green in the first round, and then took Dalton in the second round. The duo led the Bengals to the playoffs in 2011 and became instant heroes in Cincinnati. The Bengals made postseason for 5 straight years, and in the summer of 2014, Dalton signed a 6-year contract with a potential value of $115 million. But the team went through one postseason disappointment after another, including an 18-16 loss to the Steelers at home after finishing the 2015 season 12-4. Dalton hadn't played in that game because he had broken a thumb 4 weeks earlier against the Browns. The team was 10-2 when he went down. A.J. McCarron filled in competently, but not competently enough to break the team's playoff bugaboo. The Pittsburgh loss made Marvin Lewis 0-7 in playoff games and had some people screaming for his head, even though he had made the Bengals into an almost perennial postseason team. The screams grew louder when the Bengals went 6-9-1 in 2016. Then the team got off to a brutal start in 2017, losing the opener 20-0 at home to the Ravens, with Dalton throwing 4 interceptions, then following it up with a 13-9 loss to the Texans. 2 games, 2 losses, 0 touchdowns. Offensive coordinator Ken Zampezi took the fall. He was fired and replaced by quarterbacks coach Bill Lazor. Things improved after that, but the Bengals never reached 500, coming closest at 5-6 after a win over the Browns. On December 17th, ESPN's Adam Schefter reported that Lewis had decided to leave the Bengals at season's end. With his contract up, Lewis, according to Schefter, was going to pursue other opportunities. Schefter, as he almost always does, cited league sources who had told him this. And so the Bengals came into Baltimore with a 6-9 record, and many expecting Lewis, who had denied the Schefter report, to be gone within 24 hours of the finale. At one time, the day after the NFL season ended had been called Black Monday, because that was almost always the day coaches got fired. Now, however, impatient owners and front office executives had started pushing Black Monday to So Long Sunday, as the Colts' Chuck Pagano and the Raiders' Jack Del Rio would learn that day. Ben McAdoo had already been fired by the Giants, and Jim Caldwell and John Fox would exit on Black Monday. Bruce Arians of the Cardinals announced his retirement that day. Lewis, in spite of what Schefter's league sources had told him, did not resign, nor was he fired. And, unfortunately for the Ravens, his team played as if their coach's job was on the line, and they wanted him to stick around for a 15th season. Right from the start, Dalton looked very much like the $115 million quarterback, as opposed to the bumbler the Ravens had faced 17 weeks earlier. Mixing short passes with Joe Mixon runs, the Bengals quickly moved 78 yards in 8 plays, plus a key penalty when Green was interfered with by Brandon Carr on a pass into the end zone to take a 7-0 lead on a Dalton to Tyler Kroft pass. Once again, it was clear the Ravens weren't going to do this the easy way. Their first series was stopped by 2 drop passes, one by Mike Wallace, one by running back Buck Allen. When Wallace dropped another pass on 3rd-and-3 late in the quarter, many of the chilled fans began to boo. The Ravens closed the gap to 7-3 early in the second quarter after forcing a Mixon fumble at the Cincinnati 34. The offense went 3-and-out, but Justin Tucker got something out of the turnover by kicking a 46-yard field goal. With the Baltimore offense still sputtering, Dalton led another lengthy drive, this one culminating in a 5-yard touchdown pass again to Kroft. He'd had 5 touchdown catches for the season coming into the game. His 7th made it 14-3 with 4:14 left in the half. When Randy Bullock kicked a 32-yard field goal with 23 seconds left, the Bengals were up 17-3. Many natives were restless, others restlessly headed to the warmth of their cars. But then the Ravens' special teams gave them life. Chris Moore fielded Bullock's short kickoff at the 7 and returned it 87 yards to the Cincinnati 6. Given a surprising last-second opportunity, Flacco found Moore for a 6-yard touchdown pass to cut the margin to 17-10 at the break. The Ravens were still breathing. Some of the restless returned to their seats. The Ravens maintained their momentum to start the second half, moving the ball to the Cincinnati 22, apparently on their way to tying the game. But on 2nd-and-5, Flacco looked over the middle for Moore, his hot receiver. The pass wasn't perfect. A little behind Moore, who reached back, got his hands on it, and then bobbled it, right into the hands of backup cornerback Darquez Dennard. Before the Ravens could react, Dennard had broken to the sideline and had a clear path to the end zone. The only one with any kind of angle on him was Flacco, but he was cut down at the Baltimore 13 by Cincinnati defensive end Jordan Willis, and Denard jogged into the end zone. Suddenly, shockingly, it was 24-10. The Ravens didn't quit. With half a year of constant work at stake, one wouldn't have expected them to. They drove right back into Cincinnati territory, but faced a 4th-and-3 at the Bengals 17. Realizing a field goal wouldn't accomplish much, Harbaugh decided to go for it. For a moment, it looked as if the decision had backfired when Alex Collins was hit behind the line of scrimmage. Somehow, he squirmed free, got to the outside, and scored, cutting the margin to 24-17. The momentum swung back to the Ravens, and those who had stayed were making as much noise as possible. Another Tucker field goal made it 24-20. The Cincinnati offense, which had carved the Ravens apart in the first half, suddenly couldn't do anything. It hadn't gotten onto the field the first 9 minutes of the third quarter because the Ravens had gotten the ball right back after the Bengals pick six, and Dalton and company had picked up only one first down before punting. Now, after the Tucker field goal, it quickly went three and out. Flacco sensed that his team now had the chance to finally take control of the game. The key had been scoring the touchdown right away after the pick six, he said. At least, that's the way it felt to me. A lot of times when teams get up on the road and then something goes wrong, they start to think about games they've lost before. I felt we were very close to putting them in that position if we could just score. They did. Michael Campanaro, the little wide receiver, set it up with an 18-yard punt return to the 40, which became an even better return when the Bengals' Brian Hill was called for a late hit. Starting from the Bengals' 45, Flacco quickly got his team into the end zone, finding Wallace for the final 6 yards with 8:52 left. For the first time on the long day's journey into night, the Ravens led 27-24. When Wallace caught the pass that gave his team the lead, Flacco did something he almost never does. He threw his arms into the air in triumph and ran to join his teammates in celebration. Cool Joe didn't get that pumped very often, but with postseason now very much in sight, he let go, if only for a moment. The Bengals' offense now seemed officially dead. On 3rd and 6, Dalton was sacked at his own 20 on a blitz by Matthew Judon, and the Bengals punted again. The Ravens took over with 6:33 left and the chance, perhaps, to run out the clock. They got a first down on a 19-yard Allen run to their own 46. The clock was at 4:20, but on 3rd and 7, trying to throw a pass that would keep the clock running but perhaps pick up the first down, Flacco looked for Danny Woodhead, the third down running back who had been hurt for so much of the season. But the pass was broken up, and the clock stopped with 2:51 to go. That conservative play call was exactly what Flacco had been talking about. If the Ravens had taken a shot downfield, perhaps a seam pass over the middle, the game could have been over, because a first down arguably would have made it impossible for the Bengals to win. They had already used up 2 timeouts, and at best might have gotten the ball back with about a minute to go, deep in their own territory with no timeouts left. Instead, they got the ball back deep in their own territory, the 10-yard line, with 2:43 left, and a timeout, and the 2-minute warning, which is nothing more than an excuse for another TV timeout, still left. They were at their own 33 when the 2-minute warning struck and TV went to commercial. 5 or 6 commercials later, on 2nd and 10, still at the 33, Dalton threw incomplete to Brandon LaFell. But Brandon Carr was called for pass interference, giving the Bengals 10 yards and a first down at the 43. 2 plays later, Dalton looked for Green, who had been held to 2 catches for 17 yards all day, and Eric Weddle, the Pro Bowl safety, stepped in front of Green and intercepted the pass. On the Baltimore sidelines, they were in full celebration. Flacco sat on the heated bench in his usual spot near midfield, not thinking about how cold he was. All he was thinking about was the playoffs. The Ravens had come a long way to get there. But they weren't there yet. There was another yellow piece of cloth on the field. Cornerback Marlon Humphrey had been called for defensive holding before Dalton had released the ball, clearly taking Green down. Instead of it being the Ravens' ball, game over, it was the Bengals' ball at the Ravens' 47, first down. A second later, it was back in Bengals' territory at the 48 after Green was called for an illegal shift. Dalton threw two incomplete passes, then hit Croft for 3 yards, making it 4th and 12 at the Baltimore 49. There were 53 seconds left. The Bengals used their final timeout. They probably needed to go at least 15 yards, perhaps 20, to get into Bullock's field goal range. At that moment, though, they needed 12 yards, or the game would finally be over. It had started almost 3.5 hours earlier. The Buffalo Bills, who had beaten the Dolphins to keep their slim playoff hopes alive, were already in their locker room, hoping for a Bengals miracle that would end their 17-year playoff drought, the longest in all four major sports. The Ravens' defense had been in man-to-man during the final drive, which had made it difficult for the Bengals to pick up ground easily, the way teams often do when an opponent goes to a prevent defense. That was why, even aided by two key penalties, it had taken the Bengals 10 plays to get the ball just beyond midfield. But now, needing one last defensive stop, defensive coordinator Dean Pease decided to go to a cover two zone. Cover two, very simply, is a defense in which the two safeties drop deep to be sure there's no way a receiver can get behind them for a deep touchdown. The Bengals didn't need a touchdown. They needed 12 yards. Recognizing the defense as he took the shotgun snap, Dalton saw wide receiver Tyler Boyd running down the seam. Stepping up, Dalton threw a strike to Boyd, who had been in the slot on the right side. Linebacker C.J. Mosley had bluffed a blitz and then dropped into coverage. The ball just cleared his fingertips, and Boyd caught it in stride at the 23-yard line. Safety Maurice Kennedy, who had been responsible for covering anything deep on the left side of the defense, had taken a step in the direction of LaFell, who had been split wide right and had run down the sideline. When he tried to pivot back in Boyd's direction, Kennedy was off balance and couldn't get a clean swipe at him. Neither could Weddle, desperately trying to get over to help. The Ravens' last and only real chance to keep Boyd out of the end zone came from Carr, who flew into the play late, dove at Boyd, but could only get his left hand on the back of Boyd's uniform just before he crossed the goal line. The Bengals' celebration was nothing compared to the party that broke out in the Bills' locker room in Miami, which was nothing short of pandemonium. It was so quiet in M&T Bank Stadium that from the stands you could clearly hear the sounds coming from the Bengals' sideline. Flacco wasn't thinking about any of that. The stadium had gone almost eerily silent. His teammates were doubled over as if in physical pain. So were the coaches. Flacco had hung his head in shock for a moment. Seconds later, he was looking at the clock. There were still 44 seconds left. The Ravens had all three timeouts left. "Crazier things have happened," Flacco said. "I just watched something completely unbelievable happen. We, the offense, had to go out there thinking there was still a chance." There were numerous problems in all this. For one thing, the Ravens simply didn't have a big play threat. They had evolved into a dink-and-dunk offense. They had averaged 8 yards per reception on the day. Second was the score, 31-27. Nothing short of a touchdown would do. Third, the Bengals would be in an absolute prevent defense, making certain the Ravens couldn't complete anything long. Bullock kicked the ball short of the end zone, meaning Campanero used up 6 precious seconds, returning the ball to the 27. Flacco quickly completed a short pass to Benjamin Watson, who stepped out of bounds after a 5-yard gain. Ball on the Baltimore 32, 32 seconds left. Flacco had to try to complete something deep, or at least semi-deep. But defensive end Carlos Dunlap broke through, and before Flacco could even think to step up and throw, sacked him for a 9-yard loss. The Ravens were now 77 yards away. It was 3rd and 14, and the clock was down to 28 seconds. Flacco took a timeout. He tried to find Wallace over the middle, hoping the play might at least get the ball close to midfield for a first down and give Flacco a couple of Hail Mary shots. Vincent Ray broke up the pass. It was 4th and 14. The clock was at 24 seconds, but that didn't matter unless the Ravens picked up a first down. With the Bengals playing deep, Flacco threw underneath to Watson, just wanting a first down and a couple of shots at the end zone. Ray brought Watson down a yard short of the first down. It was 7:57 p.m. on New Year's Eve. In Baltimore, it was midnight. 25. No one was more surprised by the Ravens' last-second collapse than Alex Smith. With the Chiefs locked into the fourth seed in the AFC, regardless of the outcome in their regular season finale in Denver, Smith had been given the week off by Andy Reid. This was done for two reasons. First, to give him some rest time, to heal up a little from the various bumps and bruises of the season, and second, to get a 60-minute look at Patrick Mahomes, even in a meaningless game. Since Smith didn't have to do any prep for the Broncos, in the unlikely event he got in the game, he'd already seen them once, he spent a good deal of time watching tape of the Ravens, figuring they would be the Chiefs' opponent the first weekend of postseason. I thought playing at home, playing well, they were pretty likely to win, he said. When they lost, I was shocked. I was also bummed because I'd wasted a lot of time looking at their tape. The opponent instead would be the Tennessee Titans, the first AFC wild card. The Bills, who would become the second wild card after the Ravens' defeat, would play at Jacksonville. The Patriots and Steelers were the AFC's top two seeds and would meet the first weekend's winners in the conference semifinals. In the NFC, the Eagles and Vikings had both finished at 13-3, but the Eagles got the top seed based on a better conference record. The wild card games would be between the third-seeded LA Rams and the Atlanta Falcons, and the fourth-seeded New Orleans Saints hosting the fifth-seeded Carolina Panthers. Only four of the previous season's 12 playoff teams had returned: the Patriots, Steelers, Chiefs, and Falcons. Atlanta was the only NFC team to repeat, and it did so as the number six seed. Five of the eight non-repeaters had losing records, the Giants suffering the worst drop, going from 11-5 to 3-13. Three of those who were home for the playoffs, the Giants, Raiders, and Lions, fired their coaches. Jim Caldwell got the gate in Detroit after going 19-14 with a playoff appearance in two seasons. Even though the Eagles were the number one seed in the NFC, the favorites to make the Super Bowl were the Vikings and Saints. The Vikings because of their defense and the steady play of Case Keenum, the Saints because of Drew Brees. The Eagles, even playing at home, would be underdogs to anyone they played because Nick Foles would be starting at quarterback and Carson Wentz would be cheerleading from the sideline. The Patriots, as always, were the favorite in the AFC, especially since they would play at home if they met the Steelers in the conference title game that most people were anticipating. Smith wasn't concerned with any of that. He just wanted to beat the Titans, knowing his team wouldn't be the least bit intimidated going to play in New England a week later after the way they had handled the Patriots in September. The Titans quarterback, Marcus Mariota, was in his third season in the league. He had been the number two pick in the 2015 draft coming out of Oregon after winning the Heisman Trophy. Jameis Winston, who'd won the Heisman a year earlier, was the number one pick. Mariota was, it seemed, the ideal NFL quarterback. 6'4", 222 pounds, and fast. He had run a 4.5 240 at the combine. He'd missed some time with injuries his first 2 years, but had played in 15 games in 2017. Still, it hadn't been easy for the Titans to make postseason for the first time since 2008. They had been 8-4 before a three-game losing streak in December put them on the playoff precipice. The Jaguars, one of the NFL's surprise teams, had wrapped up the division and were 10-5 coming to Tennessee for the finale, which the Titans ended up winning 15-10. The tape of the game wouldn't be sent to Canton, but that didn't matter. After the Ravens lost to the Bengals, the Titans moved up from the number six seed to the number five seed, sending them to Kansas City. Aside from the wasted time on the Ravens tape, neither Smith nor the Chiefs minded facing the Titans. They had lost a galling game to Tennessee a year earlier, blowing an early 14-0 lead and losing at the buzzer on a 53-yard field goal by Ryan Sukup, an ex-Chief. Getting another shot at them at home, this time in postseason, was fine with Smith. Nationally, the Chiefs and Titans weren't considered a great TV draw, so they were assigned to play the first game of the weekend, 4:30 Eastern kickoff on ESPN. The Falcons, Matt Ryan, and Rams, Jared Goff, would play the night game. And then on Sunday, the Bills and Jaguars, not exactly a glamour matchup either, would play early, followed by the Saints, Drew Brees, and the Panthers, Cam Newton. the quarterbacks were always the key to ratings. I'm glad to play early, Smith said. It would be nice to win, then kick back and enjoy the other games. Smith's entire family, parents, brother, sisters, along with spouses and children, were coming to town for the game. It was, after all, the playoffs, and